Welcome to today's discussion on new advances in the treatment and assessment of HPA access dysfunction. Today's webinar is part one of a two-part series. The presenter who will be leading our discussion today is Dr. Thomas Williams. Dr. Williams earned his doctorate from the Medical College of Wisconsin, where he studied molecular immunology. Since 1996, he has spent his time studying the mechanisms and actions of natural-based therapies and is an expert in the therapeutic uses of nutritional supplements. As VP of Science and Regulatory Affairs for Orthomolecular Products, he has developed a wide array of products and programs that allow clinicians to use nutritional supplements and lifestyle interventions as safe, evidence-based tools for patients. Dr. Williams teaches at the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy, as well as the University of Minnesota School of Pharmacy. He is also a faculty member of the Fellowship of Anti-Aging, Regenerative, and Functional Medicine. With that, I'll turn it over to our presenter to begin the content portion of today's webinar.
Okay, thank you, Lissa. Welcome everyone this evening. As you may notice, my voice is a little bit sketchy tonight, so hopefully we'll make it all the way through the 60 minutes and the question and answer period at the end. So I'll get started while my voice is still in good shape here. So I want to start with, instead of just an agenda, I'll give you sort of what I've been calling my stressful mission over this past, it's almost been a past decade, but more recently since about the last 24 months. And I've been focusing quite a bit on this idea of helping clinicians incorporate HPA access therapies to prevent and treat stress-related chronic dysfunction. So we're gonna talk about that quite a bit today. But probably one of my bigger missions and challenges that I've had is realigning the functional medicine community and maybe broader terminology beyond the functional medicine community to research related to HPA access and related data. And I think, as you'll see here in a minute, I think the functional medicine, integrative medicine, whatever we want to call it, community, has done a very good job of understanding stress as it relates to chronic disease, but perhaps because of some older information that hasn't really advanced like the data has advanced in the last several decades. So that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. And part of that has to do with nomenclature. So I'm going to talk about creating a common nomenclature that's useful and accurate for the functional medicine community. And part of the issue, I think, is that we're missing some good nomenclature here. And then the other part that I've been working with and thankfully able to connect with labs like ZRT to encourage more uniformity in the way the labs test for HPA access dysfunction or function, both in the units, the nomenclature, the collection times and instructions. Some of that we're going to talk about in the next seminar, not this one, but this is something that I've spent quite a bit of time on, and it's taken a while to get some discussions going in this area. And I'd like to, you know, be part of the spear as we're moving to promote more research related to testing and HPA access intervention, especially from a functional medicine sort of model rather than just a sort of a clinical approach. So as many of you may know already, I've spent quite a bit of time recently in what I call a stake in the ground putting this book together. We're going to talk a little bit more about it at the end, but it really is designed to help teach, and much of what I'm going to talk about tonight is, almost all of what I've talked about tonight is going to be in this book that we published last August. So I kind of oftentimes refer to the idea of HPA access dysfunction, the way we think about it is oversimplified and under-leveraged. And so that's going to be kind of one of the ways I'm going to start this idea. So we've all heard the phrase, probably something like this, we need to talk about your adrenals. And the phrase adrenals has become sort of shorthand for lots of different things, including stress, including fatigue, including you know, just sort of some sort of hormonal imbalance, whatever. And I'm hoping that eventually we can remove that sort of terminology from our vocabulary. So why do I say it's oversimplified and under-leveraged? Well, first of all, it's very oversimplified in the idea that adrenal function or adrenal dysfunction is rarely a defining feature or status of the stress response system. And with the exception, of course, of adrenal insufficiency, This oversimplification often misses the root cause of HPA axis and stress-related phenomena. And we're going to talk quite a bit about this idea as we move forward. But while we often think we're measuring adrenal function, we're really not measuring the function of the adrenal gland per se. We're just measuring the outcome of the adrenal gland output. And why I say this is under-leveraged is that really the most powerful therapies we can used to support the stress response are not directly related to supporting the adrenal gland, although we often refer to it as adrenal support. And because of that, we're often overlooking some of the other things that we can do, or maybe most of the other things that we can do, which are at the level of the brain usually or at the target tissue. So we're gonna talk about that a little more. So the other thing is this notion of adrenal fatigue. This language has been used by many of us, including myself, over the years. And, you know, many of us, including myself and others, are trying to migrate away from that. Interestingly, the Hormone Foundation, Endocrine Society, has, you know, come out against the idea of this phenomena of adrenal fatigue, saying it's not a real medical condition, that there's no scientific facts to support the theory that long-term mental and emotional and physical stress drains the adrenal glands. And you can see here, these are from online. You can still download these from the Endocrine Society. Basically, these documents that they're trying to promote for patients to make them wary of doctors that are going to try to treat them or call what they have adrenal fatigue. And even, as you can see from this statement, taking supplements when you don't need them can cause your adrenal glands to stop working and may put your life in danger. So obviously, this hyperbole is out there warning against adrenal fatigue. So the question I have is, are they right? And so my answer is, well, sort of, in the idea that the term adrenal fatigue does not properly describe the stress response that leads to changes in adrenal hormone output or a sense of fatigue. So while it's true the adrenal glands are involved in the stress response, and fatigue is often a symptom that some people have if they've had stress situations for a long period of time, but the term adrenal fatigue probably is not, well, it doesn't describe what's, so my answer to that is we should stop using this terminology. Now, it's out there in a million places, so stopping that is a little bit more challenging. But I think the Endocrine Society is woefully wrong, and they're incorrect in their assertion that long-term stress has no effect on adrenal hormone output, let's say cortisol and DHEA in particular, or that no test is capable of assessing the effects of stress on human physiology. So, you know, they've taken and obviously they've thrown sort of the baby out with the bathwater, thinking that the terminology. So in that case, we need to rethink how we discuss adrenals and start using different terminology. So the idea is to embrace the real biology of what's going on and understand how the adrenal glands fit in with that without getting caught in the oversimplified and language that's not helping us. So nomenclature does matter. Obviously, primary adrenal insufficiency is real, though it's relatively uncommon. And generally, it's not considered a stress-related chronic disease phenomena. Most of it's related to sort of an autoimmune adrenalitis. So the idea that primary adrenal insufficiency, unfortunately, secondary and tertiary adrenal insufficiency are also misnamed. They should actually not be called adrenal conditions, as most of those are not involved in adrenal function. But primary adrenal insufficiency is very different than adrenal fatigue, or what has been known as adrenal fatigue. Stress-related changes in adrenal hormone output, let's say changes in cortisol, either high or low, are regulated by HPA axis adaptations primarily in the brain and are not caused by fatigue or the inability to produce hormones by the adrenal gland. So the adrenal gland losing its ability to produce cortisol is not the cause of hypocortisolism, as we'll see later in the discussion. So I think most everybody on this call probably has some background of this. The adrenal glands respond to the brain, and this is a really an important factor. Obviously, most of us know that. And so the brain is really in control of what's going on throughout this process. A lot of that has to do with the interpretation of the stressful signals that come from outside the brain, whether it's inside the body or outside the human altogether, and then how the brain interprets the feedback of its own production in this case of cortisol primarily. And so feedback inhibition as well as outside stress signals become sort of the key to determining what the brain is going to do. So I show this picture here, which is just a real classic example of the power of the feedback inhibition that we need to keep in mind. We all know that cortisol output from the adrenal cortex, when it gets in circulation, will bind to glucocorticoid receptors in the brain, particularly in the anterior pituitary and in the various components of the hypothalamus. And that signal tells the brain sort of how the body's signaling cortisol. Do I have enough? Do I have too much? Do I have too little? And then sends the signal, appropriate signal, to either upregulate or downregulate that. Two areas where that are very familiar to most of you that have known feedback inhibition. In the middle here, you can see in panel B is a patient with major depression. Their cortisol production is not interpreted by the brain as being strong. They have a low feedback inhibition, and so they interpret the cortisol level as being lower than it should be, and therefore they then produce more CRF and ACTH, and therefore in many patients with major depression, they have higher output of cortisol when you measure it either in the serum or the urine or the saliva. Conversely, adults, with PTSD have a hypersensitive feedback inhibition, whereas they see a small amount of cortisol as being robust, and that ends up shutting down or reducing the signal that comes from the pituitary. They have lower amounts of ACTH and compensatory lower levels of cortisol in adults with PTSD. So we're not gonna talk about this in detail. I just wanna show you that while the stressors may be similar on these individuals, the interpretation of the way the brain understands that is gonna be also highly affected by the feedback inhibition. So here, the adrenal gland in the PTSD patient doesn't lose its ability to produce cortisol. It's just getting less of a signal to produce cortisol, and therefore you have lower levels. So what's the terminology that I'd recommend? Well, I think overall, probably the best terminology or the best generic terminology would be something like HPA axis dysfunction. Obviously, it's pretty generic. There's a couple other things that I think are kind of interesting. We could call this the maladaption to stress, or a stress response dysfunction, or an adaptation to stress with consequences. So we'll see over time that HPA axis dysfunction, which is stress-related, is sort of an ongoing adaptive or a maladaptive process, which then has consequences. And so what are some of those consequences? Well, there's lots of disorders that have been listed. This is actually a review by George Crusos, who's done a lot of work in stress and disorders of the stress system, and specifically the HPA axis portion, showing that there's a number of conditions which are associated with either an increased activity of HPA axis or a decreased activity of HPA axis. And in some cases, individuals move from one to the other, typically from a condition where they have maybe years of increased activity to a maladaption or an adaptation to that. We might call it a proper adaptation in some cases, to a decreased activity of the HPA axis. It doesn't always work that way, but clearly there is a relationship between those over time. So some other language that I think is important in the literature, and especially as you're describing patients, is to use very specific terms about what you're seeing. So if you have low cortisol, that's hypocortisol, and we may not know exactly why it's hypocortisol, but that's the most descriptive and oftentimes the most information that we can say at the moment. High levels of cortisol we can just call hypercortisolism. DHEA or DHEA sulfate, you know, elevated levels, which we often see in PTSD, or low levels, which we often see in probably most other patients, especially with chronic stress. And then other terms that are used in the literature that we'll also talk about a little bit is something like high allostatic load or high allostasis. In the literature, there's a sort of a specific term for burnout, which is it's a very technical term in some ways to try to describe somebody who's actually gone into a hypocortisolism due to chronic stress. So why do we have the stress response? Essentially, I tell people the stress response in and of itself, as most of you know, is a survival mechanism. It's really designed, especially the HPA axis portion of it, is really designed to maintain effective blood supply, oxygen, and nutrition to the portions of our body which will keep us alive, the brain, the heart, skeletal muscle. It often, metabolically, it will increase energy production. So we need glucose, we need fatty acids, we need amino acids. And so they're pulled very, very quickly or liberated from various body stores so they can be used in an immediate situation. The body's trying to optimize ATP, energy production, etc. And so the idea, if you've heard of a Bruce Ames triage theory, which is the idea that the body stores up or uses up its antioxidant capacity for the immediate moment, not worrying about tomorrow, as it were. Well, the stress response is very similar, that it's trying to achieve that physiological resilience at the moment at the expense of a long-term metabolic reserve, which we know eventually will have a deleterious consequences. So the way I explain this in simple terms oftentimes is, The same roads that emergency vehicles need to use are the same ones that you and I need to get used to get on our daily functions, whether it's to work or to the grocery store. So as we'll see here, the metabolic functions that the stress response uses has to use the same receptors, the same pathways that manage our normal glucose regulation, our normal metabolic regulation. And when we're on stress, everyone has to go aside until the stressor components are resolved. Unfortunately, if you keep sitting on the side of the road every day when you're going to work, you might not have your job very long. So same thing with your body. If you have to keep putting off certain metabolic functions in order to deal with a ongoing stressor, those long-term metabolic functions are not going to be functioning as well. So some of the terms, like I mentioned, allostatic or allostasis, allostatic load, this is coined by Bruce McEwen and his group. And it really, he used this terminology as a way to explain something different than we normally think of as homeostasis. But allostasis is really the ability to adapt to change. And you'll see that there's a number of different definitions that people use. Probably the best definition that I think captures what allostatic load means, it's the metabolic cost of reestablishing physiological integrity after a stressor. So if you're under a stressor, whatever your body has to do to get you back or to relieve you of that stressor, that's the metabolic burden. And in some cases, it's going to be greater than others. So if you're under constant stress or a constant need to reestablish your integrity, that metabolic cost is going to start adding up over time. And so he described a couple different ways that you could think of allostatic load. As you see in the upper left-hand corner, this is just a single stressor where you see a physiological response going up after the stressor and then a recovery that happens. And to the right of that, you can see that over time, the body is really adapting to that stressor. So you can see the first stressor. I don't know if you can see my mouse. Hopefully you can. But the first stressor, and then the second one, you can see it doesn't go up as high, so you don't get quite the same physiological response. And over time, it slowly comes down. And we call this a normal adaptation to stress. But oftentimes, you can see below, we have some other factors. In some cases, the hyperactive response could be a no recovery, so you have a very strong and very long physiological response to a stress. That's not going to be good. Or conversely, you have these repeated hits over time, over and over, and your body doesn't downregulate. It sees every one of those stressors each and every time, and you don't have sort of an adaption to that stressor, and so you're going to constantly need more and more metabolic energy to recuperate from that. Obviously, a low response, a hypoactive response can occur. Either it's, you know, what we might say is flatline, something happens and you just simply don't have a capacity to respond. Or in the case of something like PTSD in the lower right-hand corner, you can see that a very potent stressor is triggers a very strong and too soon adaptation, a downregulation of the response, and you basically have a very low response that's really caused by a hyperactivation of or a traumatic downregulation of the HPA axis. So most of you are familiar with the stress response on the left-hand side, which we're not going to talk too much about, is the adrenal medullary system, where we have a very quick nerve impulse that goes to the adrenal medulla that allows for the secretion of catecholamines, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. And this obviously is the major part of the fight or flight response. On the right-hand side, we're going to spend most of our time talking about is a longer-term stress response, the HPA axis, which you're very familiar with. The adrenal cortex is involved in this, and we typically think of glucocorticoids in humans, cortisol, and DHEA and DHEA sulfate. Also, mineralocorticoids like aldosterone are produced in the adrenal cortex, although mineralocorticoids are only partly regulated by the HPA axis, mostly regulated by other factors. So I like to just start with this because there's a portion of this that we need to understand how the brain responds. Obviously, the brain needs norepinephrine, and the norepinephrine response in the brain is almost instantaneous. So on the left-hand side, you can see the brain could actually get norepinephrine through the slow process, if we want to call it slow, of the adrenal medulla producing norepinephrine, and that secretion getting all the way back to the brain, where then the brain can respond. Even though that's very quick, it's actually too slow. So the brain has within it what we call the locus coeruleus norepinephrine system, and that allows for an immediate release of norepinephrine in the brain that is actually triggered by CRH and other factors, so that the brain can almost instantaneously allow for that hypervigilance that's needed under a stressful response. So we're going to see, and especially if you've done a lot of research, you know that there's a lot going on in the locus coeruleus, and especially in PTSD patients where you have a hyper responsiveness, a hyper arousal that is sometimes difficult to turn off. A lot of that is going on in the brain and not necessarily being triggered by the HPA axis. So if we go back to Hans Selye's work on the HPA axis, he defined the stress response in a very macro level, a very large stress level of hypertrophy of the adrenal glands, and you can see sort of the difference here, and he did all his work in rodents, atrophy of the thymus or other lymphatic glands, and erosion of the ulcers. And so I've been talking quite a bit about this idea of the connectedness between the HPA axis response, the immune system, and the GI tract. And so always want to think of the HPA axis as being part of the surveillance system, just like the immune system and just like the GI tract. And of course, most of you know that these are quite highly regulated between themselves. And the communication between these and the regulation between these is highly important in chronic disease management. So always keep that in the back of your mind. I don't have time to get into the details. I do a lot of teaching on the immune system and GI tract because of this connectedness. So he defined what he called the three-stage alarm reaction, resistance, and exhaustion stage. He basically put animals under various stressors, and he noticed that they had this alarm reaction. Over time, they seemed to resist the stressor, and then after a long period of time, they lost their ability to resist and went into this exhaustion, in some cases, death. And he called that the general adaptation syndrome. Now, obviously, this itself was a little bit of an oversimplification of what was going on. Of course, in animals, they didn't have sort of coping mechanisms that humans have. So this three-stage model, however, though, has still made its way into a lot of the way that we interpret what's happening in patients. Sometimes it's helpful, and I think other times maybe it's, again, oversimplistic, but it still led to a lot of help in where patients are at over time. So many of you know sort of this, if we start out with these basic idea of the hypothalamus, getting information from the higher orders of the brain, the hippocampus, which allows you to, you know, assess your surroundings using, you know, higher orders of the brain to assess threats that are around you. The amygdala brings in information on past history, things of memory, including core areas of fear, and that, along with information coming from the rest of the body, is consolidated in the hypothalamus and produces a signal to the pituitary, which we call CRF or CRH, both of the same corticotropin releasing hormone or factor. And we'll see here in a minute why CRF is sometimes used, because there's actually a family of these, not just one single hormone. The pituitary and the anterior pituitary then converts that signal, as we'll see here, into ACTH, and then that's what signals the adrenal cortex to produce glucocorticoids, and we have that traditional kind of feedback loop that which we already mentioned. The glucocorticoid feedback is at the pituitary level. It's also at the hypothalamus level. It's also at the other areas, including the hippocampus in the brain. Almost every tissue in the brain has glucocorticoid receptors. So like I said, I've been spending time really thinking about this, and so while we don't have time to get into all the details of every one of these slides, I want to really kind of just bring to your attention that the hypothalamus is not just one set of nuclei. It's all these different sets of nuclei that bring in information from outside the body, from inside the body, measuring temperature, hunger, all these sorts of things. And then, of course, some of the big signals that come in from the optic nerve that allow for circadian rhythm. So the two portions I mentioned on here are the suprachiasmatic nucleus. You can see on the right-hand portion here, that's the area that sits right above the optic chiasm, and it's responsible for triggering the circadian rhythm of the HPA axis. And then the paraventricular nucleus, which is near the top there in green, and that is essentially the nuclei that is a consolidator of all the other pieces of information and allows for a single signal or a single set of signals to go from the hypothalamus to the pituitary. So those become sort of the two that you often see in the literature being discussed about their signaling capacity. Now, on the left-hand side of this slide, you can see the sort of a cartoon version of both the information in the paraventricular nucleus, PVN, and you can see the stressors come from the CNS, and the other signals, the circadian information, comes from the suprachiasmatic nucleus, SCN. And you'll see a dashed line that goes from the suprachiasmatic nucleus all the way down to the adrenal cortex, and that's because there's direct innervation between the suprachiasmatic nucleus and the adrenal cortex that helps amplify the circadian portion of the HPA axis. And so that's kind of interesting. I'll mention it next time about how that affects the awakening response, because there's a direct effect there. So that information you can see on the left-hand side. So that signal then goes over to the picture that's on the right. This is a picture of one of the cells in the anterior pituitary. And so we have a corticotroph cells that essentially responds to that CRH. And so CRH, corticotropin-releasing hormone, binds to its receptor, and we're going to talk, there's a couple different types of receptors. That essentially signals two different factors. One is that we have synthesis of ACTH, which is sitting in preformed granules inside of these cells, and then when you have a signal coming from CRH, then you also get the releasing signal. So both the formation of ACTH and the release of ACTH are under the control of CRH and vasopressin. Vasopressin, sometimes called arginine vasopressin, is the other signal that can also come from the paraventricular nucleus that gives some trigger or some signal to the anterior pituitary to produce ACTH. And of course, that's going to then produce our cortisol, which then has a feedback inhibition directly on these tissues. So I mentioned the fact that there's multiple forms of CRF. So again, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but this is an area of research which is getting a lot of attention right now. CRF or CRH binds to the CRF receptor type 1, which is the one that we see in the anterior pituitary, but you'll see that there are several other CRF-type molecules. We call them urocortin 1, 2, and 3, and they will bind to various receptors, whether some cross-react with the CRF receptor type 1 and others bind to CRF receptor type 2. Now, why is this important? Well, because we're learning more and more about these components. Now, I apologize, this is a little bit difficult to see. This comes from some of George Crusoe's work in endotex.com, and you can see here the different forms of CRH, R1, receptor 1, and receptor 2, and they're distributed not just in the brain, but they're, as you can see here, they're distributed all over the different portions of the brain, but they're also distributed in the adrenal glands, in the skin, the GI tract, etc. Excuse me. So why is this important? Because we're starting to learn that not only is CRH a common factor within the brain signaling the stress response, but it signals a number of other tissues throughout the body. And we've also learned that CRH is actually also produced not only in the hypothalamus, but also produced in other parts of the body. So why is this important? Well, the immune system seems to be regulated or partly by CRH signaling, and in the case of mast cells and macrophages, actually it is able to produce CRH. So we're starting to learn a little bit more about this as a family of compounds, hormone signals, I should say, outside of the brain and perhaps within other tissues like the immune system, the GI tract, perhaps in the skin as well as other areas. I'm going to be talking quite a bit about this in the next book that I produce. This is actually one that's going to be coming out in a few months, Gastrointestinal Health, a Lifestyle and Nutrient Approach, and I'm going to actually talk about the role of CRH in functional gastrointestinal disorders because it's thought to play a role in IBS quite a bit. So we know that CRH affects gastric motility, colonic motility, and about 70% of IBS patients have some sort of HPA axis abnormality, and it may not just be signaling only from the brain, but it may be signaling through the immune system, let's say. So the immune system acts as a very proximal brain, if you want to use it, in the GI tract, probably as it's regulated through the stress response, but it's not just being measured by cortisol alone, it's actually being measured by CRH signaling. So this is a whole other area. If you haven't heard about it or don't know much about it, this is really new, and we're not exactly certain how to approach this in patients yet. But so the pituitary obviously is involved in interpreting more than just the CRH response, and so obviously there's a relationship between the HPA axis and all of these other functions. And most of you know that there's a tight relationship between HPA axis function and thyroid function and growth hormone in female and male hormone cycles. So there's a lot of relationships here, so it's not just this sort of one pathway. And so it becomes important to understand how stress then can respond and affect some of these other factors. So now to complicate things even more, ACTH, which is produced in the anterior pituitary, is not produced by itself. This very long peptide, pro-opiomelanocortin, POMC, is produced and then spliced in the pituitary. You can see right in the middle, the ACTH is this sort of this portion here. It's actually two colors here, but ACTH is this portion here, and that is spliced and sent out from the pituitary. But you can see other splicing events that also occur. Some of these splicing occurs in the pituitary. Some of these splices occur after it leaves and gets to various target tissue. And so, what do many of these other things? Well, we have a number of melanocyte stimulating hormone, MSH, and you can see various components of that. You can see beta-lipotropin over here, and so you can see a number of different factors. Why is that important? Because there's a family of melanocortin receptors, melanocortin 1 through 5, as you can see at the bottom here. The one that we're going to be most concerned about is melanocortin receptor 2, which is the one found in the adrenal cortex, which is highly responsive to ACTH and then triggers the production of cortisol, et cetera. But you can see here that there's a cross-reactivity between ACTH and many of the melanocyte-stimulating hormones specifically in cross-reactivity. And And some of these activities affect energy homeostasis in the body, melanogenesis, so we see changes in pigmentation. And so if you're wondering why there's a lot of crossover reactivity between stress response and many of these other factors, it's not just being driven by cortisol. It also is being driven by increased POMC expression and the other splice peptides that come out from that, creating other sorts of responses that are non-ACTH driven. So this again is another area it's kind of new or being looked at as being part of the stress response that we typically don't think about. So getting to the adrenal gland, which we always think about, it's always important to remember that there are three different zones, very different cell types in the cortex, the zona glomerulosa, the fasciculata, and the reticularis. And these tissues, these cell types are very different. So in some sense, this is three different glands, at least within the cortex. And of course, the medulla represents another set altogether. So that's important, especially when we talk next time about the relationship between cortisol and DHEA and DHEA sulfate, and maybe even aldosterone production, that these are not the same cells. They just happen to be adjacent to one another for, let's say, historical or embryological reasons. And why is that important? Because as we get into the chemistry, the biochemistry of the production of these hormones, we'll see that all three of these cell tissues are steroidogenic, meaning they all can produce pregnenolone from cholesterol. And that's the definition of a steroidogenic cell, the cell that's able to produce pregnenolone from cholesterol. It's done in the mitochondria, requires two enzymes, one that transmits or pushes the cholesterol into the mitochondria, and then what we call CYP11A1, which is the side chain cleavage enzyme. So I'm not going to get into the chemistry here, but you can see the difference between if you look carefully, you can see that there is a different expression of enzymes that allows the pregnenolone precursor to be pushed into various hormones, and the expression of these enzymes are different in these three different cell types. That's why we get different outcomes from these cells in hormone production. So the tissue response to cortisol is highly dependent on numerous factors. So when we think of this, we often end with the idea that cortisol is produced. The issue is cortisol is not just produced and then floats around and does whatever. That this is a highly regulated process after the adrenal gland is already told how much cortisol to produce. So this activity is systemic, meaning that there's factors that influence cortisol availability to most tissues. And then there are quite a few tissue-specific factors that influence cortisol signaling in specific tissues that are not affecting other tissues. And that might be in developmentally, circadian rhythm, or other factors like inflammation. So as you're going to see here, this is, I think, probably one of the biggest areas that's often misunderstood, is the ability of tissues to regulate how powerful that cortisol signal is to that particular cell or tissue. So there's really seven basic areas that can be modified, and that is cortisol metabolism rate, how quickly we metabolize cortisol, the free versus bound cortisol, the enzymes that convert cortisol to cortisone. I'm going to mention all these in detail here. The ability to affect genomic glucocorticoid signaling, which is done through the glucocorticoid receptor. There's regulation of heat shock proteins. There's something new called non-genomic signaling, or we believe that there might be non-genomic signaling caused by cortisol. And then finally, the actions of DHEA. So I'm going to go through these kind of quickly. And this is just a graphic illustration of these seven. So I'm going to kind of skip by it kind of quickly, but you can see that there's a number of different signals. Obviously, several of these may be going on at the same time in the different tissues that ultimately affect how cortisol is going to modify this. Now, I should say as an outset, obviously not all of these are being affected in every cell type at the same time or every tissue. And we also need to think of These effects are occurring at what we call target tissue, so maybe in heart tissue and fat tissue, et cetera, but also in the brain. And so many of these factors, let's say, that increase the signal of cortisol, when that's in the brain, that increased signal of cortisol then can downregulate the HPA axis, if that makes sense. So we also need to think of the brain as a target tissue, but sometimes the brain as a target tissue has the opposite effect, meaning it downregulates the HPA axis rather than just as a cortisol effect on whatever metabolism that's occurring in that tissue. Hopefully that makes sense. So 95% of cortisol is bound. The majority of it is bound in the serum by corticosteroid binding globulin, or sometimes just called cortisol binding globulin, about 80% of it, and the rest is usually bound by albumin. But we need to really think of CPG as not merely a passive way to limit free cortisol, not like a sponge, but it also appears that it's shuttling cortisol to specific tissues, often in response to inflammation. And so it seems like CPG is actually able to, you know, direct the cortisol where the body may need it at a moment's notice. And we also have learned that even though most of CPG is produced in the liver, it turns out that a number of other tissues, including, like you can see here, ovaries, placenta, et cetera, including some parts of the brain, the hypothalamus, are able to produce their own CPG. So they're able to create a response to the cortisol signal that's there. They're able to produce their own CPG and modify the available free cortisol at the tissue surface. So that's a kind of a subtle way for that to happen. Now, you'll notice in this picture on the left-hand side here, you can see that CPG, when it's bound to cortisol, is able to release that. One of the ways it releases that is neutrophil elastase, which is a protease produced by neutrophils. Well, neutrophils obviously are highly active at the site of inflammation. So as it turns out, where neutrophils gather and they're producing an inflammatory response, it looks as if the body's able to bring, you know, cortisol bound so that it's not immediately active, but as soon as the neutrophil elastase is released, then it's able to then release cortisol into that area. So the neutrophils, this could be a way that neutrophils can actually resolve the inflammatory process that they began. So this is likely one of the ways that CPG is actually able to bring cortisol to the site of the inflammation and act as an anti-inflammatory when the neutrophils are ready for that. We know that chronic low-grade inflammation reduces CPG, which would make sense because it obviously allows for more cortisol, which in the long run is not good, but the body thinks it's good because it's trying to reduce inflammation. And we'll see later that massive weight loss causes decreases in CPG, which, so massive weight loss is a stressor. It frees up more free cortisol by decreasing CPG. And then other conditions like PTSD often raise the binding globulin so that it reduces free cortisol. So this is another adaptive response, not only for producing cortisol, but then also producing the binding globulin. It's another way of managing the process. So one of the second ways is the conversion of cortisol to cortisone or vice versa. Cortisone being the inactive steroid, cortisol being the active steroid. And there are two enzymes, 11-beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 1 and 2. And HSD1, as I'll call it, is very active in the liver and the adipose tissue, CNS, and immune system. And it's able to then take cortisone and convert it to cortisol, the active component. The inactivation of cortisol typically is in water-regulating tissues like the kidney, the colon, the saliva, et cetera. And so this back and forth allows for active, already produced cortisol to be made from cortisone. Now, most of you know that licorice or glycyrrhizin derivative from licorice is able to inhibit 11-beta-HSD2. Actually, it's able to inhibit both of them, but its basic end function typically is seen primarily in its inactivation of HSD2, which then allows for the preservation of cortisol and perhaps sort of a hyperaldosteronism. Excuse me. So essentially why this happens is HSD2 is really tasked with protecting mineralocorticoid receptors. So we know that, that cortisol will bind to aldosterone receptors or the mineralocorticoid receptor. And so in those tissues where that's important, where aldosterone is very active, the inactivation of cortisol then protects those tissues from the overactivation of mineralocorticoid receptors caused by cortisol. So that's why we have this sort of system in place. And so one of the things that we'll see down the road, and people have looked at this, it can have an effect on salivary cortisol levels. In some individuals where you have high levels of cortisone, it can have some effect on how we interpret, let's say, a low or a high cortisol level. And it also could be true in urine levels as well. So HSD1 ends up amplifying the actions of cortisol. Most people don't realize that the conversion of cortisone to cortisol in the human liver and splanchnic bed is responsible for about 20 to 40% of the daily cortisol production. So it's not even the HPA axis activated, it's just the cortisone that's reserved or stored up in the adipose tissue most often, or in the liver, being converted to cortisol, which is actually creating some of this. So this is an important enzyme to understand. Clearly, drug companies would like to find a way to block this because they believe that they can have this effect on reducing obesity and fat mass and type 2 diabetes. So far, there isn't a drug out there, but there's a lot of people looking at HSD1 blockers. And of course, I mentioned this before, HSD2 is the primary one that we think of a blocking when it comes to licorice root. This can be a problem, obviously, when people have elevated cortisol and then they take high levels of licorice candy, or even licorice root extracts. Not typically a problem in most individuals unless they have salt-sensitive hypertension and or very high cortisol levels. But if you go back to some of the literature, and some of you already know this, that low levels of cortisol can then be preserved by licorice, and this was often used for Addison's disease early on, even when people didn't really know what was going on. So when we think of cortisol signaling, we often think of this very simplistic view. Glucocorticoid binds to its glucocorticoid receptor. It's moves into the nucleus, and then we get activation or repression of various genes. So this is the classic genomic signaling that we think of. Obviously, it's much more complex than that. And so because of the time we have, I'm not going to get into the details of that tonight, but there's a lot more information about how glucocorticoids are signaled. And a lot of that is affected by the different splicing of the glucocorticoid receptor. We have all kinds of isoforms of the glucocorticoid receptor, only one gene, but lots of different splicing. And that splicing then can change the way the glucocorticoid receptor works, and it can be changed in different tissues and at different times. And that really gives a lot of nuance for how the tissues can modulate the genomic response of cortisol over time. And it's quite interesting area of research. So one thing I do want to talk about is the fact that there's heat shock proteins, or chaperones. And these are the proteins that keep the glucocorticoid receptor and move it around the cell. And we've learned quite a bit about these heat shock proteins. And I can't get into too much detail here, but you can see in these colored pictures here, the glucocorticoid receptor is bound by various heat shock proteins. It helps it fold correctly. And then there are two chaperones, which maybe some of you have never heard of, called FKBP51 and 52. And without getting into a lot of details, these are basically co-chaperones that move on and off of the glucocorticoid receptor, and they change the way that they function, essentially. And we're now learning that these are very important components of the signaling capacity of glucocorticoid receptors. So, these very small co-chaperones, which, you know, like I said, most people haven't even heard of, are now being researched for their ability to change the affinity of the glucocorticoid receptor for cortisol and the outcomes that would have in tissues. So here's all kinds of different things you can see here over the last just few years, looking at emerging roles of these binding proteins for cancer, for androgen sensitivity, for chronic stress, et cetera, PTSD. One I just pulled, this just came out of the news just a couple days ago, the stress regulator FKBP51 drives chronic pain by modulating spinal and glucocorticoid signaling. So again, this is just a, this was published just 2 weeks ago, showing that this little cochaperone changed the glucocorticoid receptor in the spinal, and actually affects the way that, that your brain interprets stress and pain. And so again, this is a very active area of research showing that we may be able to modulate some of these things. So interestingly, adaptogens, one of the known mechanisms for adaptogens is actually the change in heat shock protein expression. So this may obviously not the only way adaptogens work, but this is a very interesting phenomena that we know that adaptogens can affect heat shock proteins, which then could modulate glucocorticoid receptors everywhere. So right now we have a lot of data on some of the heat, the specific heat shock proteins, but I will not be surprised to see either diet or other dietary factors, nutrients, or botanicals that may affect these FKBP 51 and 52 as well. So we're obviously looking at research for that. So this very messy slide is intended just to show you one thing on the right-hand side, which is we know a lot about most of what you see in the left-hand side of the part of the slide, which is glucocorticoid signaling through the glucocorticoid receptor, but there we know that there are effects that glucocorticoids trigger almost immediately. And we, so it's believed that there's either a membrane receptor or some other signals, which we would call non-genomic actions of glucocorticoids, and we see this mostly in pharmacological doses of glucocorticoids like prednisone, et cetera. They occur much quicker. Some of the reactions occur in cells much quicker than genomics could ever do. And so this is another active area of research, whether it's through mitochondria or whatever. So again, mitochondria are important, and so this is another furtive area of research of how mitochondria are modulated by cortisol. There's a lot of data on in the changes in morphology. This slide here shows, I'm kind of going quickly because I don't want to take too much of your time, but we know that morphology of mitochondria change when we put them under allostatic load, as it says here, or cortisol-driven stress, which then affects the long-term stability of those mitochondria. We know that when you have acute stress, mitochondria function fairly well. They increase their biogenesis, they increase their ATP production, but when you put them under chronic stress, they start losing that ability. And so that's why we get this downward regulation of the adaptive response, and we might get cellular changes, including the ability to have proper energy balance, and then we get maybe global fatigue, whether it's tissue fatigue or later global fatigue. So most of you as clinicians are fairly aware of the power of glucocorticoids, whether it's something we want to use as anti-inflammatory effects or their effects chronically on other tissues. And so we know these are very powerful components. It's very clear from research that the stress response through glucocorticoids and maybe through other mechanisms are driving some of the classic cardiometabolic symptoms and syndromes that we know. We know that glucocorticoids reduce the metabolic reserve of bone by affecting both the osteoblast function and the osteoclast function, basically giving us this long-term effect on depletion of bone mineral density, which we often see in the use of prednisone and other glucocorticoid therapies, but it's also true in long-term stress individuals that you have elevated levels of cortisol, you'll see long-term effects on bone mineral depletion. And then other chronic diseases like Alzheimer's. And so the more we look into the effects of glucocorticoids, you could say that it essentially saps the tissues of their metabolic reserve. So whatever that would be, they're going to be involved in that chronic disease pathway. We know a lot about the glucocorticoid effect on inhibiting most of the immune cell function. So obviously we often use that when we want to use it as an anti-inflammatory, but it will have a downregulation effect on almost everything else. So there's really no escaping the stress response. As many of you know, it affects almost everything. but we need to really understand it in I think a better way than we have in the past. So whether it's the HPA axis and by other mechanisms or glucocorticoids, cortisol as an end result, they're really involved in almost every physiological and metabolic process, influencing nearly every cell. And likewise, we can have profound benefits that can be realized when we understand and minimize the actions of these stressors and we begin looking at them. So where does the stress come from? And I'll finish with these set of slides that kind of break down, this down. So as we're thinking about this, stress comes from one of these four areas: perceived stress, circadian disruption, glycemic dysregulation, and inflammatory signals. If you boil down what the hypothalamus interprets as a stressor, almost all of them come from one of these four categories. So it's really incumbent upon the clinician to really understand these four areas as being, and really the questions that come from deciphering where they come from one of these areas. So perceived stress, we're going to talk a little bit about this next time as well, but things that are new, things that are unpredictable, lack of control is probably one of the biggest areas that we could define as a perceived stressor. When you feel like you're out of control, you are stressed. You'll see on this slide a little bit of information about neurosteroids. I'll talk a little bit more about this next time. The perception of stress is not just the event, it's the way that the cells interpret that information. And that can be highly dependent upon what we call neurosteroids, pregnenolone, DHEA, allopregnanolone, and other steroids in the brain. And then also neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, GABA, and glutamate primarily. These help the brain interpret that information and sometimes misinterpret that information. Circadian disruption, as many of you know, anywhere you are changing your circadian rhythm, you are going to cause the HPA axis to adjust or try to adjust to that. I don't have time to get into this. We talk about it quite a bit in the book, but I show how the peripheral clock within all your cells is modulated by cortisol and glucocorticoids. The brain, every part of the brain has a glucocorticoid receptor except one. There's no glucocorticoid receptor in the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Thankfully, thankfully we don't have any there, because they won't then get a misinterpretation from the HPA axis. The suprachiasmatic nucleus gets its information from sunlight. Hopefully we're accessed to sunlight, recalibrates continuously our 24-hour cycle, and then can feed that into the system to the rest of the tissues. And finally, these last two areas, glycemic dysregulation, which we'll talk about more in our next conversation, but inflammation. Anywhere you have an inflammatory signal, especially TNF-alpha, IL-6, or IL-1-beta, you will have a potent HPA axis signaling or axis signal. So that's going to be very powerful. Of course, cortisol has a downregulation on tissues producing TNF-alpha, IL-1, IL-6, so there's a sort of a back and forth. But anywhere you have a patient with inflammatory bowel disease, chronic joint inflammation, food allergies, chronic sinusitis, et cetera, or even obesity, which is really a low-level adipose-driven inflammation, you should be thinking about not only cortisol levels, but also, like we mentioned, cortisol-binding globulin, HSD1, HSD2, and some of these other things that we've been mentioning. So as you're thinking through the strategies, you can see in the middle here, adrenal support is a very small part of this. We know a little, but maybe we can help the adrenal gland, the specific area of the zona reticularis that produces the DHEA, with adaptogens, maybe with certain antioxidants. We know that certain vitamins and minerals can help the adrenal production of various hormones. There's a question about a glandular effects. We don't know if they're helping or not. But you can see on both sides of this, helping the brain, helping the CNS with reducing hypothalamus stressors, glycemic dysregulation, perceived stressors, inflammatory signals, circadian signals, or by modulating neurotransmitters and neurosteroids, or by balancing cortisol feedback mechanisms. These are the big rocks that are affecting the HPA axis. And conversely, on the right-hand side, affecting the cortisol or the tissue response to cortisol by modulating HSD1 and maybe HSD2, by may be affecting heat shock proteins using adaptogens, excuse me. And then a DHEA becoming a powerful tool, perhaps, in some cases, to modulate the effects of cortisol. So as I finish here, you'll see that when I say that there's lots that we can do to protect the HPA axis, and most of it is outside the adrenal gland, this is in some cases, a game changer or a very different paradigm, and we're starting to see clinicians coming around. It's challenging for some who have used the, you know, sort of adrenal support as being the major way they think about this, but hopefully this has opened up your eyes a little bit to some of the research and some of the nomenclature. Next time we're going to talk mostly about testing and some of the other factors that have been used in clinical trials. So I'll turn this over to Lissa, and she can finish, and if there's any questions, you can type them into her.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Williams. We do have some questions for you today. Let's start with this one. It seems that most patients today have multiple factors that would be triggering HPA axis dysfunction. Where do you start in tackling the problem?
Now that's, do we have another hour? obviously, you know, so right. Where, I mean, You like with all things, you need to assess the patient. You need to decide probably which ones are the most predominant, which ones are the ones that are they're saying themselves. As I'll mention next time, we'll talk about perceived stress. You can actually measure perceived stress, which I would recommend, and then differentiating between perceived stress, which is oftentimes a measure of control, and then what we typically do is what we have a stress inventory, where we actually look at life changes, things that actually have occurred in their life. Some of those are modifiable, some of those are not. And so, you know, removing stressors and teaching people to cope with things they can't change are two different phenomena. Beyond that, obviously, those three other areas, assessing their circadian rhythm, sleep, whatever is going on with them, assessing their glycemic control, and we'll talk a little bit next time about ways that we can do that specifically, but I think in most cases, clinicians, when they're looking at cardiometabolic risk or other factors, they're assessing insulin sensitivity, you know, other anthropomorphic measurements like waist circumference and things like that to get a sense of that. And then I think looking at the gamut of inflammation. So I think those are the big areas. I think you need to weigh where the patient is based on other factors. What are their other goals of their health situation? Do they have, you know, major GI related, but if there's inflammation going on and that's their cluster of symptoms that they want you to fix, that's where I would start. So, I mean, I think like with any chronic disease issue, you know, you have to kind of go through the normal pathway that you would do in that situation.
Okay, here's another question for you. When a pregnenolone steal is occurring down the cortisol pathway, do you recommend inducing transdermal or oral substitutes for progesterone or DHEA in order to buffer, or do you recommend some other intervention?
I'm going to leave that for next week. Hopefully that person can come next week, but I think we need to rethink just like we need to rethink adrenal fatigue, there is a very good reason we need to rethink the whole idea of pregnenolone steal, primarily because the relationship between the tissues does not work in the idea that one tissue is stealing the pregnenolone from another. So we'll talk about that next week, or you can go online. I've actually written a blog on the idea that pregnenolone steal is also an incorrect physiological phenomena. So we'll talk about that next week, the next time we do this.
Here's another question for you. Are there SNPs associated with increased risk of low cortisolism?
So for those of you who don't know, SNP is a single nucleotide polymorphism. Basically, are there genetic risk factors that change the outcome of the HPA axis? And the answer is, of course, there is. There are quite a few, but the question is, at this time, I don't know of any particular polymorphism which we should use in, let's say, a genetic test, and then it will have some outcome or change in the way we think about it. Right now, as it turns out, there's polymorphisms in the glucocorticoid receptor. There are polymorphisms in the various co-chaperones and heat shock proteins. There are some SNPs and polymorphisms in the cortisol binding globulin. So as there are many different things out there. I think we'll probably learn perhaps in due time that maybe one or two polymorphisms may help us know that somebody might be predisposed to one or a different condition, or maybe there's a therapy or a diet or something that they're more that are more effective in those. But I don't know of any research specifically linking a known genetic predisposition with a known outcome.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Looks like we have time for just one more question today. Let's go to this one. Are there times in our life or types of stress that are more detrimental?
Well, yeah, I think certainly the stress, and this is a whole other aspect which I mention in the book, but it's very fascinating to me that stress before you're born, or while in utero, or early in life, can be very detrimental to the HPA axis. And interestingly, so we have a lot of effects on, you know, maternal stress and the effects of metabolic conditions later on in the child's life. And we believe that there's effects going on with glucocorticoid receptors and maybe heat shock proteins and other things that are affecting the HPA axis for the rest of that person's life. Stress, if you look at, we're going to talk about this next week a little bit, or next time a little bit, but DHEA production is very high in utero, and it goes down immediately at birth and then comes back at age 5, 6, 7, and maybe starts, you know, really peaking out when you're 8 or 9. And so the HPA axis is very vulnerable, or has a very low DHEA effect and ability to modulate the effects of cortisol at a young age. And so we know stress at a very young age can be very detrimental and create long-term effects on the HPA axis, either hyperactivating or in many cases downregulating it. We also know that acute stress, like in PTSD individuals, a major trauma, either repeated traumas or like in military action, a continuous threat of life has a major downregulation. And oftentimes the literature suggests that these cannot be reversed. Some of these things, at least we don't know yet how to reverse some of these downregulations. So those create a vulnerability. And so I think it's very important, I think, to protect the vulnerable from stressful situations the best we can, and teach coping mechanisms, teach ways of understanding, as we'll talk about next time, how to perceive events as being less stressful by giving people ways of coping. And small amounts of stress then allow the body then to adapt. I mean, if we didn't have any stress, or our body didn't respond to stress, then we would also not survive. You know, we see a bus coming towards us, we would stand there until it hit us. So we need a good stress response to situations around us. But it's those acute stressors early on, or the very acute stressors in trauma, that we need to deal with. And of course, PTSD, either before it occurs, especially in the military, or after it occurs, is a big area of stress research right now, in how to adapt to that. And unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot of good outcomes yet that we know about.
Okay, thank you. I think that's all the questions we have time for today. So thank you, Dr. Williams, for leading the informative discussion. And thank you, audience, for attending today. Just a reminder that Dr. Williams' book is available at the lifestylematrix.com website, which you see on the screen.